Hi, I'm Pericles Iacovides. Welcome to the third episode of the Journalism Today podcast from the Media Innovation Studio at the University of Central Lancashire. This podcast is the place where you'll find the liveliest journalists, the smartest academics, and maybe even the most hardworking students talking about the future of journalism. This time, the name of the game, pun absolutely intended, is games journalism. A niche subfield, some would say, insofar that despite being a multi-million dollar industry, people who are not involved or interested in it will likely have never heard of big publications such as IGN or Polygon or Eurogamer. Our guests for today are game journalists Colin Campbell from Polygon and Anthony Gianagnello from the newly re-established Escapist magazine. You can get in touch with us by tweeting at MISUclan. We'd love to hear what you think. But before we meet our guests, there are two things that I feel should be explained for the people who might be tuning in who do not follow the game industry particularly close, if at all. The first one is the Gamergate controversy. I will oversimplify and gloss over many of the finer details, so if you find yourself interested in it, there are multiple articles that can be found in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Vox, and other media outlets which chronicle the events in detail. Essentially, the Gamergate controversy is comprised of two parts. The first one, the treatment of women in gaming, and the second, ethics in games journalism. However, whatever rational talking points there might have been at the start, Gamergate very quickly devolved into an all-out war online with rampant misogyny, harassment, pitchforks and torches, and all the other wonderful things that internet hate campaigns are well known for. The second thing is the concept of distributed denial of service, or DDoSing for short. Bear in mind that this is also a very abridged and oversimplified explanation. In essence, DDoSing involves overloading a website with bogus requests, such as fake login attempts, for instance, which eventually crashes the website and takes it offline. And now, with Gamergate and DDoSing covered, we can get started with our guests. I am joined by Colin Campbell. Colin, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm a video games journalist. I've been writing about games since the 1980s. I started off in print and in specialist magazines in England. Now I live in California and I work for Polygon as a senior reporter. Polygon is part of Vox Media.
So tell me, Colin, have you ever felt the need to revise an article due to external pressure, so either developers, a publisher, angry fans? And if you've ever done this, I'm curious if you felt that it was worth it at the end or you regretted the changes.
As a journalist, I often have to make changes to articles. Errors are a fact of life, but usually they boil down to, I'll say that a game came out in 2005 and it came out in 2006, or there will be a spelling error or something of that nature. But I think what you're interested in talking about is the kind of upswell of outrage that we see quite often these days from the internet, for want of a better description, when somebody in games journalism dips into areas such as misogyny, racism, you know, the kind of things that are dividing the world of politics, of sports, of entertainment, and of games. And video games are no exception to
yes,
that.
Exactly.
And you can make the argument that games are actually a really intense focal point of it because that, you know, it's a new technology. It's a technology that is or an entertainment form that is changing so rapidly that it's kind of at the forefront of this this move to include more minorities, to be more diverse and more representative of the population as a whole, coming from a situation where it really was not any of those things. It was pretty much made for young men, and it was made by young white men. And we're seeing those things change very rapidly. And that is, you know, that is happening alongside the sort of stuff that we're seeing coming out of Brexit and the White House and all the other political miseries of our time.
So what I gather from this is that you've stood your ground. You haven't given in to the peer pressure or the trolling or the whatever, or the financial pressure perhaps, because if a publisher doesn't like what you've written, they might. I mean, there have been documented cases of, say, Kotaku writes something and then Sony doesn't like it, and they're like, we just won't invite you to our events.
Yeah, and I mean, there's two different things going on here. One is the audience, and it's interesting that when I started in my as a journalist, I worked for magazines, and those magazines were generally bought by children or by very young teenagers, and they had nothing to say to us in terms of being outraged or cross or angry with the things that we wrote, because the things that we wrote were really just about the product. You know, is this product good? Is it fun? Is it not? That's the sort of stuff that we wrote about. And there wasn't what you call a fanboy culture in the way that there is now. When I see or when I receive trolls and outrage on the internet, and I have done, it happens to me maybe once or twice a year, there is not really a pressure to change anything. You know, sometimes there's a discussion internally about whether the article was appropriate in terms of how it approached the subject, but there's never a conversation like, oh, we should go back and change this or delete it or anything of that nature. It's more a kind of question of weathering the storm and finding, you know, and also within all the kind of rubbish that you have to deal with, there are people who have interesting things to say, who have perspectives that are worth listening to. And, you know, it's important as a journalist, as an analyst, as a critic, to be open to that kind of criticism. And it's not to say that it's enough for me to go back and say, oh, I've changed my mind about this thing, I should go back and rewrite it. But it's more about being on that journey of sort of discovery and learning, where you think, you know what, in the future, I'm going to take a slightly different tack on this particular issue.
I see. But
in terms of the other part of it, which is publishers getting angry, it's a super interesting topic. I mean, in the old days of magazines, publishers and the press, games publishers and the press, were very close to each other. We kind of needed each other in this sort of symbiotic relationship. And nowadays, you can be a games journalist and just never talk to a games company.
Yeah, I will segue into the second question. It's quite similar to the first one. But have you ever found yourself in a situation where, I suspect I know your answer after what you said just now, but have you ever found yourself in a situation where you feel a certain way about a game, but because, again, developers or publishers exerting pressure on whichever magazine you're writing for, or a very aggressive fan base, you just feel you can't be honest? Because there is a very real example of this, and it's not too long ago, with Jim Sterling, when he gave Breath of the Wild a 7 out of 10. There was very significant backlash. There was hate mail. His site got DDoSed. And 7 out of 10, that's not a bad score. What would have happened if he gave it a 4 out of 10 or a 3 out of 10?
I mean, yeah, it happens all the time. And I faced it. I wrote a preview about Rock Band, I think, a few years ago, Rock Band 4. And I was trying to make the argument that these games are difficult when you're introverted and shy, as I am in public spaces. And, I was trying to kind of talk about that aspect of the phenomena of games in which you stand in front of other people and sing. But it just got this ridiculously overblown negative feedback, even from people inside games journalism, which I thought was ridiculous. And it was badly misunderstood, in my opinion. I'm still proud of it now. But I do actually have an anecdote about a situation that you're talking about. I used to work for IGN. And I remember it was a place that was certainly not as kind of woke as sort of Vox Media and Polygon and many of the other game sites, and even IGN now. I remember that they had a feature, a weekly feature, I think it was called Babe of the Day. And we're only talking about, I don't know, 7 years ago. And I worked really hard to just get rid of that. And it cost me a lot of political capital within the organization. And later on, I was fired. I just wasn't a good fit. But I do remember that I wrote an article about harassment of women in online games. And I talked to women who'd faced this sort of thing, talked to developers, filed the story. And the editor who was editing my piece, he came back to me and said, no, we're not going to run this. We believe that this is a saturated issue. I remember it was the word he used. And I was furious because I didn't believe it was saturated. And this is before, obviously before Me Too, before even Gamergate. It was, in my view, a relevant, urgent issue that needed to be reported, and they just didn't want to deal with, I believe, the fallout that they would get from their audience. They were afraid of their audience.
This perfectly segues into the next question. Before the Gamergate controversy erupted, you were very vocal about standing up for women's rights within the gaming industry and community. And your interview with Emily Matthew and Gamma Sutra and the story you wrote entitled Piranha Frenzy pinpointed many of the issues surrounding misogyny in the workplace and online. And being a known supporter of Zoe Quinn during this time, as well as being a public voice against the unjust treatment of women in video games, how has Gamergate, the controversy, affected the articles you write now?
I actually am not comfortable with the notion of me, quote, standing up for the rights of women. I'm a journalist, I'm a reporter, and my job is to report on the stories that are happening right now. And I think that in terms of, the evolution of video games and the video game industry and the video game culture, when people look back at this time, of course, they're going to be talking about creative advances. And you look at something like Red Dead Redemption 2, they're going to be talking about technology, Xbox One X, but they're also going to be talking about exclusion and entitlement and all that sort of stuff. So it's my job to write about those things. It's not necessarily, what I believe privately is only a part, I think, of what I do, which is to write about situations where video gaming is being poisoned and is being held back by sexism, by racism, by exclusion, or by shabby treatment of workers. So I write about those things because that's what the news is. Yeah. That's what the story is. In terms of Gamergate, I wrote a feature recently about gaming's toxic men, and all it was, I went out and I spoke to a lot of women and individuals who'd studied gender in video games and in mass entertainment, and I hardly wrote anything. I just let them do the talking.
Yeah. I took a look at that article. It was interesting. It was very interesting.
Yeah, and there was a lot of people who were very angry about it, as you would expect. And we're just not surprised when that happens. We have situations internally where I will hand over the keys to my Twitter account. I just won't look at it for a week or so, and somebody will just block or mute or delete the most awful tweets, because they do get you down. I had one situation a few Christmases ago where I wrote a roundup of the year previously, and I wrote about the kind of backlash against misogyny and the backlash against the backlash, and there's a streamer at the time who wrote something sort of awful about me, writing about just a terrible journalist I am and what a terrible writer I am. And of course, an individual writing that doesn't really matter, but when that individual has they have a huge following, then you have to deal with two or three or four or five days of literally ping, 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 ping coming into your, and they're all saying horrible things about you, and it gets you down. And it sort of spoiled my Christmas a little bit. And all I had was, I'd stated what I felt was a fact that games are quite often made without thinking carefully about the perspective of women or of minorities. And I think that nowadays that is changing, that it's not just us in the press who were ostensibly, the sort of target of Gamergate's ire, the whole corruption in games journalism thing. But it's the games publishers, I think, who have reacted the most to what happened. But they haven't reacted in the way, I think, that the Gamergaters actually wanted.
I was reading your article about sort of what you just said, that turning a blind eye to employee harassment and sort of allowing a toxic work culture to exist where crunching is not a thing that happens for weeks, but for months or years and so on. And that sort of, it really made me think, because I don't know if you're aware, but there is an ongoing lawsuit between Quantic Dream, David Cage's company, towards former employees and a few French media organizations that reported on alleged hostile workplace environment. And this whole situation just really made me think, because when you're a game journalist and you decide to report on such a thing, you basically paint crosshair both on yourself and on your sources. Even if they're anonymized, they can often be found out because of what they said. So how exactly do you deal with this? How do you deal with this danger? How can you avoid it? How can you mitigate it?
Oh, it's I don't want to sound too pompous here, but it's simply by telling the truth. That, if a person from company X calls me up and says, look, I want to tell you about what's happening at Company X and some of the practices there. I need to talk to more people about that. I can't just rely on that one person's opinion, even if it's completely persuasive. And so I have to talk to other people. And you saw that Jason at Kotaku this week talked to 90 people in order to run his story about the working practices at Rockstar. And, you know, that's how it's done, is by, you know, checking your sources, checking your facts and getting it right. And I'm not familiar with French libel law. I'm not familiar with the story about Quantic Dream. But I suspect that Quantic Dream are on a hiding to nothing, that they would be much better off focusing on their internal issues rather than on people talking to the media and the media reporting what are, in my opinion, completely valid news stories. And it's good to see that companies in the US, or some of them, you look at Riot Games and the talk about the culture there and how they've at least ostensibly come forward and said, look, we're going to make some changes because this isn't good enough. And I think the function of the media, and it doesn't matter what you're writing about, the function of the media is to shine a light on things that people in power would rather you not shine a light on. And I'm really glad that in my lifetime, video games journalism has moved from basically just treating these things as products to treating them as human endeavors that affect people in all sorts of unusual and interesting ways.
I very much agree. And there's this very interesting thing where you often have the Streisand effect come into play, where it's something that if they just had done nothing about it, it would have probably just, it would have hurt them possibly, but maybe a little bit. But then by sort of very aggressively litigating towards it, then they kind of make it a big deal and then everyone knows about it. It's really sort of ironic how it works.
Yeah, and you see it again and again in public life where people will take on the media, and, you know, we're in the middle of some awful situations now with the president and the media. And it, I think in the long run, in the long curve, it doesn't work out well for people taking on the press, because the press is simply an arm of the people. We're there to tell stories about things that, unfortunately, usually bad things that are happening to people, whether they be being sort of required to work 60, 70 hour weeks, or whether they are always and forever having to look at video game heroes who don't look like you, don't speak like you, and don't have your sorts of cultural sensibilities.
Thank you very much for your time, Colin.
Okay. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for the interview.
That was Colin Campbell. And now, without further ado, let us move on to our next guest, Anthony Agnello. We will discuss the troubled relationship game journalists often have with their audience, and more. I'm joined now by Anthony Agnello. Anthony, why don't you tell us a thing or two about yourself?
Hello, my name is Anthony John Agnello. I am the associate editor at the newly relaunched Escapist magazine. I've been working as a journalist since 2004 and have been working in games journalism since 2008, writing for outlets. I started at 1UP way back when, and have published for Edge magazine, Engadget, Joystick, Games Radar, and many, many, many others.
With video game journalists, more so than other kinds of journalists, there's this expectation that you obviously should be able to write and write well about whatever you're reviewing, but you should also be able to play it. And there are numerous occasions, like the relatively recent situation with Cuphead, further back it was Doom, and I'm sure there's myriads of examples like that, where the community viewed someone who was reviewing something as, why is this person reviewing it? They're not good enough, they don't understand it, and so on. And I was just curious where you feel that a game journalist's skill level should lie.
This question is very close to my heart, Pericles, because I was actually working as the social media editor at VentureBeat when the entire Cuphead brouhaha happened with Dean Takahashi. I was at ground zero for all of that. And I'm going to say now what I said then. Dean's ability to play that game at an expert level has absolutely no bearing whatsoever on his ability to evaluate it and to offer a critical perspective on that game.
Hmm.
I think the idea that all games should be reviewed by people who have like a ton of skill at video games is just asinine. There should absolutely be reviews of games by people who are really, really good at those games. But there should also be reviews of games by people that are really, really bad at those games. There should be reviews about games by people who have never played a video game before. Diversity is going to benefit everyone. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, it all depends on what outlet are you writing or producing your review for? What is the context of your evaluation of a game? You know, I tend to write, at The Escapist, I write reviews that are critically focused. You know, I'm sitting there playing a game and I'm saying, no, how many guns does it have? How many levels does it have? How many different unlockables does it have? That's not my primary concern.
Yeah.
My primary concern when I'm reviewing a game is, what does this game say about the human experience? What does it say about the human beings who made it? What does it say about the history of the medium? What does it say about X, Y, Z? I want to dig deeper, and that's what my reviews are going to be about, because that's appropriate for the outlet I'm writing for. But, you know, are you going to see that kind of review at Engaged Family Gaming, where all of the reviews are supposed to be about, is this game appropriate for parents to play with their kids or for kids to play on their own? Is that appropriate for a review at IGN, which is incredibly mainstream and focused on a more consumer report style? Is this game a good value? What are its technical achievements? You know, at the end of the day, there are many, many, many different outlets that are your sort of traditional press outlets, right? But
yeah,
then there are hundreds, thousands of individual, independent critics working on the internet, on a YouTube channel, on a Tumblr, on their blog, whatever. And all voices deserve a seat at the critical table when it comes to, you know, what is their background in games? You know, I understand that we're sort of going to drift in this direction anyway as we continue talking, but, you know, a few years back when I was working as a freelancer, I got it in my head that what I really wanted to do at the end of one summer was I wanted to focus on reviewing soccer games, football games, because I'm not a soccer fan. I know very little about the sport. Like, I understand how it's played. I know the rules. But when it comes to international teams, I'm completely disengaged. I hadn't played a FIFA game in 20 years at that point. And I said, you know, what the hell do all of these different outlets need from somebody to sit there and be like, here's what's in this week's FIFA Ultimate Team update. Here's how the ball handling physics are changed this year. That shit is covered. And I said, you know what? Let me review all the soccer games that came out this year. Let me review them all. And we'll see what a complete outsider makes of that experience. And it was fascinating. And I feel like the outlets I was writing for got a lot out of it. I got a lot out of it because it was a really interesting critical challenge. You know, it got me out of my comfort zone. You know, a game doesn't just need to challenge a critic. A critic needs to challenge themselves. And, you know, all of this is a long-winded way to say, you know, that is just one example of saying, here's a perspective that is different than what people are expecting. You know, the sort of amorphous quote-unquote average. And that's useful. That's beneficial. You know, every single game in the world could be somebody's first.
Yeah, I suppose the reason why I'm a bit torn on this situation myself, because I kind of see both sides of the issue. Like, I don't think either solution is perfect, because the thing is, like, when I'm like reading a car review or watching a car review video on YouTube, I expect the person that is reviewing it to be able to drive the car properly. Because like if I review the car, I don't have my license yet, I'm learning how to drive, and I get in a car and then I crash it in after I go 1 mile, and then I say that and then I make a sort of a video describing my experience with the car reviewing it, then I don't necessarily think that my skill level is good enough to be able to talk about it.
Sure.
But then I can also see what you're saying, because if you have like the esports pro whatever or the best gamer ever reviewing something, then they breeze through the game and then someone is like, oh, this looks really nice, I'll buy it, and then they die 20 billion times at the first boss and then they just rage quit the game.
Anyway, I'll move on to my next question for you now, Anthony. What would you say is the most interesting, unexpected, or profound change or changes that have happened and shaped games journalism and the game industry over the years?
I mean, the most profound change is, and this is the most profound change in almost every damn walk of life at this point, is that the barriers that exist between audience and creator has almost become non-existent at this point. And, you know, I started my career in journalism in 2004, back when I was writing for a website called Nerve.com. Long, long ago.
In a galaxy far away.
In a galaxy far, far away. I wonder if they mean old Ben Kenobi. No. I started writing about video games professionally in 2008. That was really when I started covering games regularly. So this is my 10th anniversary. I'd done some stuff here and there before that, but it wasn't, you know, really my job. But it's been my job for a decade now. And even in 2008, the ability for the average person playing video games to access and directly engage with the people that made that video game, it almost didn't exist. Like, if you wanted to, you know, go to some developer, like, if you wanted to, like, go to EA's website and track down the, like, corporate relations email or press email address that's just like the general email of EA, you could probably shoot them an email, but it wasn't like you were gonna get to freaking Will Wright and start being able to talk to him about the way that The Sims was made, right? But now, in 2018, developers and fans and publishers and critics, everybody is able to reach one another. You know, the reality of social media has changed the act of game creation. It's changed the act of covering games. It's changed the act of playing games. And that is the most dramatic thing that I've seen change in 10 years. And it changed, like, we could all see these things coming 10 years ago. But the extent to which they changed and how quickly, I wasn't prepared for. I wasn't prepared in 2012, just 4 years after I started in this industry, to see Mass Effect 3 come out and see this tide of fans be like, that ending is bullshit! I hate the ending of Mass Effect 3! It's terrible! And to see that wave crash on top of BioWare and EA, to the point that they changed the ending of the game, that never could have happened before that.
I'm curious if you think, like, if this bringing, basically erasing the barrier and the wall and the whatever, the moat between the creators and the consumers, would you say it has had an overall positive or negative influence? Because most people initially would assume, oh, yeah, that's very good. It's
right.
Yeah, it's the best. But then if you have someone who is actually on the internet a lot, especially in the sort of quote-unquote, not dark web, but darker corners of the
Sure.
Internet. They're like, have you ever been on the internet? That's horrible. So yeah. I'm curious, did it sort of even out the dark side of the internet and the light side of the internet? Is there a balance in the force, or did it sort of mess everything up?
Is there a balance in the force? Oh my God. It's so hard to say, Pericles. It's so hard to say, because the reality is that we're still in it, you know? Mm-hmm. You can't really comment on history while it's still happening. And it's tough, you know, because even before that moment, you know, the ugliest parts of the internet were already starting to, you know, affect people's lives. You mm-hmm. know, I think back to 2007, you know, before I even started writing about games, and 5 years before, you know, the Mass Effect 3 incident, when Assassin's Creed came out, and the original Assassin's Creed came out in 2007.
I remember playing that a little bit on my PS3. Fascinating. I didn't like it very much.
Yeah, it's a rough draft. It's a rough draft, but it's a fascinating rough draft. And it received middling reviews, you know, it got some eights, it got some sixes, it's got some sevens, and it was either just after the game came out and the reviews were happening, or just before, and it was getting a lot of, like, fanboyish press, some horrible, disgusting person on the internet drew a webcomic of Jade Raymond, the producer of Assassin's Creed, who just recently was at EA. She was a producer on the Star Wars Battlefront series over the past couple of years, and she just left EA. This webcomic was this just lewd depiction of Jade Raymond performing sex acts on people in exchange for positive press of Assassin's Creed.
Oh, dear.
And it was disgusting. Yeah. And, you know, this was put out on the internet where people could see it. I still remember it happened 11 years later. Like, that information hit the world, and, you know, that was a sign of that barrier breaking down. Yeah. And that's horrible. No human being should have to have disgusting small people drawing things of them and then forcing them to look at it. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's horrible. Yeah. But at the exact same time, I can sit there and look at, just yesterday, that game company, the producers of Flower and Journey and Flow, on their Twitter feed, they were marking the death of a member of the Journey community. This person who'd played for many, many years and was well known as somebody who loved playing that game and always acted as a shepherd for new players. And to see the creators of a game that had affected the lives of players so deeply and enriched their lives so much mark the passing of a member of that community in such a tender, acknowledging way, it was this perfect embodiment. It's like a platonic ideal of the meeting of art and artist and audience all at once.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I can think of another example of basically the same thing almost happening in Borderlands 2, where there was this NPC who was modeled after a player who loved Borderlands 1, was super involved, and then I think they had cancer or something, but unfortunately they passed. And again, it's the same kind of gesture, immortalizing someone who loved their games in their games.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous, you know, like that sort of moment. And those moments, the Borderlands moment, the Journey moment, that wouldn't be possible unless that barrier came down, right? Like, that wouldn't exist. I don't know, man. Ask me in 10 years. Ask me in 2028.
I'll have a better
answer.
I'll hold you to that. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
Anthony.
Of course.
I hope you've all enjoyed this episode of Journalism Today. And again, please do drop us a line at MIS-UCLAN on Twitter with praise, love, indifference, or even outright hostility. That's all for now. See you next time. Goodbye. Thank you.